are listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Now from the Nowcast Network Studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here to my right, we've got Martin Page.
How you doing, Mike?
Next in, we've got Scott Gershon. Across the table, we've got Bobby Summerfield.
Hello, Mike.
And next to Bobby, we've got Andrew Sheps.
Hi, Mike.
And next to Andrew, we've got Rob Arbitier.
Hello, Mike. Mike. Thank you. Am I that predictable?
And guys, I'd like to welcome with us today writer-director Michael Davis.
Hey.
And also one other welcome. I'd like to welcome Bobby into being a regular attender.
There are only so many weeks in a row you can do this. So he's been here every week.
I know. That's so.
You've got to get off his back soon.
That's the last one.
I'm out. What are we going to do with the Bobby Blob doll? Yeah.
We don't want to talk about
that's
that.
That's a personal problem.
Who blew that up?
Didn't know that about that one. You shouldn't have told him that.
That's it. That's the last one. I can't joke anymore about that.
Don't worry, he won't be here next
time. Speaking of Bobby, how did things go with the Emmys?
Well, as you know very well, crap, actually. Didn't win a thing. Went there, rented a tux, went down there. What did I get? Absolutely nothing. Terrible, no. It was a really great experience, but no, unfortunately, didn't win this year, but great shows won, and, you know.
But you told me the girls were rather attractive.
Now, I've got to tell you, yes. You see, the lucky part was I was invited back for the Friday night party, and, of course, along with soap stars come soap star wannabe lings.
Who was the hottest girl there?
So, I couldn't tell, really, but all I know is it was better than getting an Emmy.
Her name was Emmy?
Yeah, it could have been. No, it was good. It was really good fun. It was nice. Yeah, it was good to be my first time, so it was really great.
So Thursday, is that where they gave out the technical Emmys on Thursday?
Right, exactly, because music is considered part of the technical side of things, and so, that's why I was there.
Don't you think that sucks that they have to separate the technical awards with the artistic awards, and you have your own lunch, not a nighttime thing or whatever? I just don't think that's fair.
They're
making it a ghetto.
Whatever. Anyway, let's get the actors in. But you know, you're exactly right. Yeah, it's that's what it was. But it was about 3.5 hours long, and it was quite funny.
Did you have to get up and go pee?
About three times. Yeah, well, I was also doing drugs, so you know. So it was good fun. It was really good fun. A good experience, worthwhile the visit, definitely. Except I had to rent a tux. That was the only downside to it. I looked like a right penguin. But anyway.
Hey, where was the Thursday Awards ceremony at? Was it at the Kodak?
Yeah, same place. They were in the same...
Was that the Jack in the Box?
Exactly, right around the corner, actually. They couldn't afford Jack in the Box. It was...
you know what? There's always next year. Right?
Absolutely. Thank you. That's definitely true.
Or, you know, maybe it could be like Andrew and all of a sudden you get an award that shows up.
You know, that's exactly it. You know? I'm going to keep the tux just in case the UPS guy rocks up.
Did you find the carpet?
You know, good point. I found the carpet.
I think it's easier at the Kodak because it's not round. Staples, it's a little tougher.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, what we're talking about is Andrew couldn't find the red carpet to the Grammys because he was nominated for a Grammy. So,
I got it. Well, I think you shouldn't be so upset because, you know, they have this theory that once a director wins an Academy Award for Best Picture, they never make a good movie after that. Or they never make a fun movie because they are now I'm an important director.
That's a good point. My mate actually won excluding you, of course, but a friend of mine won a Grammy a couple of years ago for Ray, and I said to him, congratulations, you know, a couple of months later. I said, how's things going? You must be busy as hell. He said, you know, the phone hasn't rung once.
Yeah, too expensive.
He said, everybody's like, oh, no, he's gone to Grammys. His price has gone up, and it's, you know.
Yeah, so anyway, it was a blessing. Now your best work is in front of you.
That's the way I look at it. Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael. And you'll be so famous, there'll be a series of Bobby dolls.
Absolutely. I'm just going away. I'm glad he's sitting next to me. It's really good. He's speaking nice and holding my leg. It's brilliant.
That's pretty funny. Well, like I said, there's always next year. Hey, I wanted to mention to you guys that we're going to go tech for just a second. I just upgraded to 7.3 on Pro Tools, and It's pretty nice. Like 7.3. Martin, we're going to go 7.3.
Okay, Mike, if you say so, I'll follow you.
Wow.
No, is that inches?
I'm sorry, I'm not folding in half for anyone. This show isn't going to get out.
Wow, we are on the edge.
On the edge.
That was really good.
What about presentation?
That was excellent.
Good timing. Wow, did you guys have writers or what? But anyhow, Pro Tools 7.3, really liked it. Liked the VCAs. I thought that's brilliant. And the fact that you can edit video. So if you're doing any kind of spot mixing, you can line up your video to match your audio. And I just think it's a very worthwhile. And it's actually running a lot better on the Windows machine that I mix on, Pro Tools 7.3. So, so far so good. So,
it even works in Commodore.
I just wanted to, I had to give that a plug because I've lived with it for about a week now, and it's just a great upgrade. You know, sometimes they hit and sometimes they miss, and this is definitely a hit, I think. Another thing that I wanted to talk to you guys about is, last night, I was doing a demo for some technology with a company, and, I had the, president of the company and the manager of this project that I'm working on, and sitting there, did all my homework, prepped all my files, did everything I needed to do, and it was absolutely a total washout. The equipment that I was using that was supposed to work just totally failed miserably. I mean, I knew within the first 10 minutes that it was not going to work. This is not going to work. And so I had these guys there, and they're all looking at me, and I had to pull out my laptop and pretend like I was doing something. But it was just a total complete...
Like he's doing now.
It's a total...
Like he always does, actually.
No, it was a total complete failure. And I thought that was actually pretty interesting, and I wanted to bring it up today because I wanted to ask you guys if you've ever been in a position, and later on we're going to do a whole podcast on things like that, where you've just totally failed miserably. I mean, it just did not go your way.
I've got a very recent example. On Saturday, I was mixing a song for somebody, and he came over, loved it, tweaked it a little bit, printed it, all the versions, pulled his hard drive off the machine, and I thought, you know what, let me put it back on because I want to burn you a CD, because I hadn't bothered to burn him a CD. Plugged the drive back in, nothing. Dead. Wasn't even spinning.
Are you serious?
And felt like it was about to melt.
Oh, my God.
Gone. Completely gone. So he had to go get a backup of the tracks from elsewhere, and then yesterday, off of an early version of the mix with the CD, flipped the phase and started matching things back up, and thank God I mix on a console.
Wow.
Because all the automation was still there, all the EQ, all the outboard gear.
That's right.
All I had to do was remember all of the editing I'd done and all of the plugins I'd done in Pro Tools. But it was a disaster. This kid was looking at me like I had no idea what to do. I've never had a hard drive fail like that before.
Wow, just didn't even attempt this.
Wouldn't spin, was humming and getting really, really hot.
So do you, when you start projects, you don't have two hard drives?
When I'm working on my stuff, yeah, I always have two hard drives and I always back up before I take it off. But he brought one drive, and normally I copy the files onto my drive, and that's why I was putting the drive back up. Like, you know what? I'll copy the stuff, burn him a CD.
Right.
Gone. It was pretty incredible.
Like, now explain to me, how do you do that phase? How do you flip the phase and what you do?
It's the best way to do a recall. I mean, if you're mixing completely in Pro Tools, you just open up the session and you're recalled. But when you're using outboard gear and things like that, I had a CD of a slightly earlier mix in the day.
Okay.
So I just dragged that into Pro Tools on a separate stereo track, then routed the output of my console through Pro Tools on an aux, flipped the phase of the mix, and then compensated for the delay of it going through. So I'm lining up a printed mix with my live mix. And then when I had to figure out where I had the faders set on the guitar tracks in Pro Tools, just move the tracks up until the guitar disappears. And then I still hear some bass, so move over to the bass, move the bass up and down until it disappears.
That's cool.
And finally, you're really only left with delays and reverbs, which aren't the same each time you do them, or anything you're distorting, because it's not the same.
Right.
But anything that is the same every time you play the mix will disappear. And we managed to get the mix back in about 40 minutes.
Wow.
That's a trick we used to do in the old days when I used to screw up wholly, like bussing an instrument to a wrong track when you're on a multi-track tape machine. I'd have like something playing and by mistake bust something to a track, so you'd have the wrong instrument and itself. What you could do is you can bounce it out and flop the phase of that instrument and add it to itself, and essentially it phases, cancels itself out.
You can do that, by the way, for noise reduction. Find the really bad frequencies that you've got, flip the phase.
Yeah, well, subtractive EQ as well. You do that with parallel EQing and stuff like that.
Wow, that's a great hint. That's a great idea. Rob, you ever been in a situation where...
The biggest screw-up?
Or not a screw-up or a flame-out or, something just goes wrong.
Well, actually, you were actually there for one of probably my worst flame-out
ever. He actually caused
ever, it. Which was... He might have... No, I don't think he caused this.
No, I did not.
But it was on a Stevie Wonder tour. We were in the Far East on a very remote island, truly in the middle of nowhere. And we used to use Synclaviers and Waveframes and a bunch of different workstations on the tour. And it was my job to put together a spares kit for all the stuff we used to carry on the road. And the Waveframe had been very reliable, and I just hadn't had time or hadn't taken the time to do a spares kit because the thing had never let me down. So we ended up doing some shows about, 15,000 miles from home, something like that.
Singapore and
out in that area. And we did one show that was right on the beach, and it was really humid and really hot, and the Waveframe just exploded. And everybody just assumed that I had a spares kit and that I'd be able to just fix it, but I hadn't put together a spares kit, but nobody knew that. So I'm there standing on the beach thinking, I am just completely screwed because half the show, you know, wouldn't play right without the Waveframe. And there was no, Waveframe Service Depot in Brunei or anything like that. So the closest place that had parts was LA, and there was no way to get the stuff there the next day. It would have taken 3 or 4 days. And I ended up spending hours just ripping the Waveframe apart. And I put together, it was a gigantic system, and I found all the parts that worked and built a little tiny system out of it that worked and got us through the show. It was like a MacGyver thing. But it was completely because I had screwed up. We had tons of spare parts back in LA, and I just never threw them in a box.
See, I'm always paranoid. I go to the set with my shot list and my storyboards, and I always bring at least two copies, one folded up in my pants, right, another one hanging, because I always know something's going to go wrong. I'm, like, super paranoid.
Which is wise.
You're super confident. I salute your cockiness. Nothing more will go wrong for me.
I never said that again.
He got over that.
Yeah, I got over that quick.
But
that
we had another good one on a Stevie Wonder tour where on stage, half the equipment was 110 and half of it was 220 for the power. And for some reason, they actually would have power strips with American plugs on them that were 240, and someone plugged one of the keyboard racks into the 240, and it was not a 240 rack. And that was it. Every single thing in the rack was completely
fried.
Can I tell a story that's not quite techie but kind of a screw-up?
Absolutely.
All right, so on my student film, my sound guy had my Nagra and 3 days' worth of tapes, you know, and he didn't take the Nagra in at night. And he lived down by USC and, you know, bad neighborhoods. He left the Nagra in the car. So we're waiting for him the next day in the morning. He doesn't show up for an hour, hour and a half. He finally shows up, and he's in tears. And he goes, someone broke into my car, and they stole the Nagra, right? And I'm like, oh, man, what am I going to do? You know, should I ring this guy? And this is a good thing for karma. I ended up hugging the guy and saying, you know, what can I do? You know, if I'm mad, it's whatever. But will you do me a favor? Will you go back to the neighborhood and see maybe they threw out the tape so at least we can get 3 days' worth of sound? So he goes back, and he comes back an hour later and says, I found the Nagra and the tapes. It was in a gully, and nobody knew what it was. They just threw it away.
Wow.
And I feel like karmically, because I didn't beat the guy up, if I had beaten him up, he'd go, screw this guy. I'm not going to go. He's an asshole. He went back and, you know, look.
That's a great story.
That's excellent.
That's great. Don't beat up sound guys.
That's right. There you go. There you go.
Hey, Scott, you have any more stories?
Yeah, I do have one, and I think Rob knows about this one. I was working on True Lies with James Cameron.
Yeah, I remember this one. I do remember this one.
I love the movie. That's a great movie.
Yes. Well, what happened was the Waveframe, when it first came out, would not accept reverse time code. And reverse time code doesn't even exist now with Pro Tools. But in those days, you can play backwards and forwards on MAG, and they would actually put out real time code backwards and forwards. So the Waveframe takes about 30 minutes to boot up. Actually, we're probably realistically 15 minutes.
It was 15 minutes. 30 minutes to
but
lock
the
up.
Thing was, it was the longest 15 minutes. So what would happen is the mixer would, I say, hey, look, don't go backwards. Or if you do go backwards, let me know. I'll go offline. Yeah, whatever. So he goes, boom, backwards, crash the system. So this is going on all day long. So Jim's like, hey, you know what? Give me another gunshot here. Okay, I'm going to do a gunshot. All of a sudden, boom, backwards, I'm offline. We want to do the gunshot. Got to wait 15 minutes. It's not something you really want to tell James Cameron to put one little gunshot in for 15 minutes. So after being pulverized for about 48 hours of this, I'm like, I didn't invent the thing. It's just something that's triggering the sound. So it wasn't going very well. And
well, because it only had to get backwards time code for like a tenth of a second and it would crash.
So every sound that was going in, the system was crashing, and we'd have to wait 15 minutes. And there's a lot of 15 minutes of that. So that wasn't working well, and I frantically called all over town looking for a way to cut out backwards time code. They had Lynxes at the time, and we were putting these weird relays. So when it went in reverse, the relay would kick in, but it still had that little tenth of a second, and it would crash the system. So we finally found out Rob had a system that just – it was a character generator that would not generate backwards time code. You put it in, it wouldn't reshape it out, so it was good to go.
And I have to say, that was the most freaked out phone call I've ever gotten in my entire life. Scott sounded – do you remember how you sounded?
No, go ahead.
It was sort of like, Rob, I'm calling from the dubbing stage, and I think I really need your help with this. It was like that. It was like if Hal had taken a bunch of downers. I really need a solution to this problem, and I need it right now. It was really like that. And I had no idea what to do, but I did remember because I was upset that this this time code reader box didn't do backwards time code because I needed backwards time code. And so he was telling me he didn't want it, and I was thinking, well, that's the one thing I hate about this box, so try that. And that ended up
like, our company's like, well, we'll send a work order. We can do a check. It'll take a couple of days. I'm like, you don't get it. I need it right now. I mean, I will get a driver to get that and bring it right. Yeah.
You know what? I have to say, all this tech talk just sounds like you're talking about sex. Backwards time code, I need it right now.
Hey, it's and on that segue, Martin. You ever had any of those classic just it all goes wrong moments?
Well, there's two things that come to mind. One of them involves you.
Oh, no.
But we'll get to that after. But the first, I didn't really know how they rectified this, but back in the 80s when we were making an album, Q-Phil were Dancing in Heaven, we were using analog tape, and the guitarist opened a – right when we were mixing, he opened a can of Coke right next to the tape. And we didn't really think anything was wrong with that until about 15 minutes while we were mixing, and suddenly all the tops started to vanish, and we just couldn't understand. We kept on blaming the mixer, going like, put some top on this. He's going, it is bright. I'm doing everything I can. And then somebody sussed out. They were looking at the tape going around, and they could see that it was bubbling. It was actually seething, which wasn't a good thing. And they rushed the tape through London into a taxi, and some guy somewhere was able to scrape the garbage off. But we came very, very near to Dancing in Heaven not coming out because of just opening a can of Coke. So that was very nerve-wracking.
That's pretty bad.
Very nerve-wracking. But the second time, I think you were with me, Mike, on stage with me when we were playing, I think, Cleveland in front of something like 50,000 people. And as soon as the...
Cincinnati.
As soon as the opening bass note hit, the whole PA, which was my nightmare because you're leading the band, just blew up.
Really?
Except for my microphone, which meant I had to talk to people for about 20 minutes while Mike was reloading all the computers. And I've never been so terrified in my life. And you start finding that those things that you really don't want to say to 50,000 people, you do say to them over. And it's really loud as well. Somehow, though, Mike put it all together, and we saved the day, and luckily the crowd was in a good frame of mind. But that was very nerve-wracking.
That's because your looks over your shoulder.
Mike, do something!
I'm not sure if you were there.
Did you hear the crickets in the background?
No, it was very quiet for a while.
I'm not sure if you were there for this, Mike, or actually, Andrew, you might have been on this tour, but there was one Stevie show that we did once. It was at the end of a European tour. And it was, the last show was in Germany at a big stadium in Germany. And it started to rain about 2/3 of the way through the show. And they hadn't expected rain, so they hadn't prepared for it. And the rain started coming down in sheets right towards the stage. And at that time, we used to have the Synclavier, which was about a $600,000 Synclavier, sitting on the front of the stage. And the rain was just washing right into the front of the Synclavier. It had vents and they started to look like drains from all this driving rain. I just thought, okay, this isn't going to end well. The last song on that tour, this is a long time ago, the last song was Skeletons in Your Closet, which is like a real heavy beat, and then it ended with a big boom. Well, the Synclavier blew up right on cue, right at the end of the song.
Perfect.
And that was the end of the show.
They must have all applauded that.
Well, it really exploded. I mean, flames came out of the thing.
Great pyro.
Pyro out of the Synclavier. And that Synclavier ended up having to go back to Vermont and be rebuilt, and it worked. It took about a year and a half to fix it. They had to rebuild it from scratch. But it literally exploded at the end of the show, and everybody thought it was on purpose.
and I, at a Kiss concert.
Right. That's what it looked like. And I told Stevie, because he was considering, you know, an encore or do another song, and I said, we're done. We are totally completely done. Plus, I mean, we did a few shows with him in the rain where you'd see him reaching around for the harmonica on the piano, and he'd be patting around because the piano would always have a deck for his harmonica on top, and his hand would be splashing. And you'd see the water on the piano splashing, and the water is flowing down onto the strings. And it's not really good for the instrument.
Let me tell you, rain in concerts. Actually, when I was key teching for Martin, we did a show in Nuremberg, and it was pouring rain. It was pouring rain, and I was just glad that Martin was on a wireless system, because water was dripping down his bass, and then all the key racks I wrapped in plastic, and I'm over there just biting my nails, just hoping nobody dies, you know, and they forget the equipment because, you know, all those voltages that you have up there. It was just
but
rain.
The girls in wet t-shirts.
the crowd was into it though. The crowd, they stayed the whole. I mean, I was amazed that crowd.
Well, they're in
the
Germany. It always rains, so I think they were quite used to it. But it was a terrifying moment because our other two guitarists. They didn't have wireless.
No, they didn't.
It's really dangerous.
It really was. And the stage was covered, but the wind was blowing right at our face. Yeah. So it was like, oh, man, that was just
exciting time. So.
Bobby, you have any?
Yeah, I do, actually. Believe it or not, well, I had a second life or life prior to this one. I lived in South Africa for 20 years, and I toured with a band called Jaluka, which became Johnny Clegg and Savuka. And lots of the gigs we did were in rural African areas. So it was basically not much electricity, if anything, not much security, if anything, and different people that wanted to come see the band. Anyway, long story short, one of the screw-ups, many of them, but one was I had a Midas console, and it had a power supply, you know, big console, and it has a separate power supply sort of system. I went to the shop, got the truck and packed it all and everything. I was a funhouse mixer. Checked it all and left happily, merrily, 3 hours to the gig, but forgot the power supply back. Let me paint the picture. Can you imagine, it's Friday night, and these guys, there was about, I think, 7,000 people there. They really were hard. It was in the middle of apartheid, and they really wanted to see the band because it was a multiracial band, and it was a statement sort of thing. So they'd been drinking for a long time, and they were not really pleased about... What's up with the band? I've paid my money, and where's the thing? It turned into a complete riot, and that literally, we had to run. We ran and ran into the hotel for our lives, literally.
That explains a lot about you.
It does, really, basically, because I was in a so.
You guys are making me nervous. Not bringing your power pack, not backing things up. I mean, whoa.
Hey, good hands here. Yeah, I know. Come on down.
No, it's just, you know.
That's when I go, Mike, I got to go back to the demo stage. I'm going back.
Thankfully everything's
Can
there.
Can I ask you, Bobby, were you in fear of your life, really, with that gig?
Yeah,
it was
actually,
that bad?
You can ask Magda. For about 9 years working with a band, it was a standing joke between Johnny, who's my buddy, and I. I used to resign and get fired nearly every gig because out of 7 years of touring, I saw literally three people got killed at the concerts, and it's just a lawless land. You know, it's a third world. Wow. It was third world South Africa, and I was in fear for my life. One, because, you know, being white in a black township where it's a bad vibe, they don't know that you're there for the right reason. They just see you as a white person. So when alcohol starts flying. So, yeah, a couple of times it was real scary.
Well, and it was actually your fault.
Exactly. Hey, you know, was I going to say that? I was like, nah. Power supply. Who said you needed a power supply with this? It didn't say so in the manual.
I do want to add on to Rob's story, though, about the not being prepared, because we were on another Stevie Wonder gig and the waveframe blew up. And this is when we were in Singapore, and the waveframe, it was another one of those 220 down the 110 line. And this time, Rob wasn't panicked that much because he opened up his briefcase and he brought out a CD, and he had all the tracks that we needed on a CD.
Yeah, funny how I learned a lesson eventually.
Karaoke!
Well, we can use the most complex equipment known to man, or we can pop in a CD if that doesn't work. And, you know, once or twice that did save us. And Stevie didn't like that at all because he liked the flexibility of actually having all the original source sounds. He's not the kind of artist who likes playing to a track. But, you know, if the show is not going to be able to go on, you do what you got to do.
And you know what? It was a great show, too, though, because when Stevie goes on his little tours off the set list, and, you know, the whole band has to follow anyhow. So mm-hmm. It keeps it
interesting.
It does keep it interesting.
Talking of that, just sidebar, Paige has been sending me YouTube stuff today. He and I have been going backwards and forwards with great bands from back in the day. And have you guys, just complete sidebar, but kind of sort of about live gigs and things going wrong and right, there's some really great footage up there of like the 70s and 80s, right?
Yeah, there's some fantastic stuff, really, when you just, you know, it leads on to, one thing leads on to another, but Bobby sent me some Earth, Wind & Fire stuff that, and I, you know, I'd worked with them through that period, so looking at that was really
amazing.
Great. And then that led on to, like, Stanley Clarke
playing
School George Days on Old Grey Whistle Test in England, which was frightening, frightening musicianship, and that's one of the things that...
Heatwave was fun, too.
That was great, but it's one of the things we were talking about, that there seems to have been that lack of love of musicianship that we felt in that era. You looked at a band and you said, this was a great band, they played well together, or the rhythm section was great. We seem to have lost that, because when you look at some of these Old Grey Whistle Test performances, you realize these bands were phenomenally tight together, and you knew they'd rehearsed well together, you knew they'd grown up together, like early Genesis, you could tell that these guys rehearsed for years together. So when you go back to the YouTube stuff, and it leads on to Jaco Pastorius, leads on, you just get so stimulated that you remember that you've forgotten how great these bands played together. Musicianship was amazing.
How proud they were to be great musicians.
They were.
They were proud musicians. They were like, yeah, I can play this thing and I'll show you.
Yeah, it was very great. Inspiring, wasn't it, Bobby? Really
so you guys, like, you'll find a YouTube video and then send it to Bobby, and Bobby will find one. And eventually, who actually gets to the part where you're doing the Drunken Squirrel video that everybody sends around?
Oh, we don't do that, Mike. No, we're a professional. No. We don't do that kind of stuff.
We do send a lot of porno back and forth. But normally I'll vary each other because we like that.
We only do the squirrel stuff with porno, don't we?
Yeah, we do. He's got a couple of really rude porno squirrels at his house.
Good friends of mine.
Yeah, they really are. That tail of his, poor.
That is so wrong.
At least they didn't say anything about peanut butter.
Well, you're the one who talked about llamas, right?
All right. Well, so is there something with Alvin and the Chipmunks here that I don't know about? Yeah.
Sit a little closer, I'll tell you.
But one of the reasons why I wanted to bring it up, and I'm glad everybody had a story, is because eventually, if you're out there listening on the podcast, you're going to run into one of those moments where things are just going to go totally to hell. And you know what? You will survive. You know, you just will, if you, you know, just think it out and figure it out.
Or become religious or something. That's
or the Scott story. Just remain calm.
That's right. Remain calm. But, you know, and I don't think you get anywhere in this business unless you go through a couple of those.
And it makes for great stories.
I'll tell you something. Be paranoid. That's the best thing to be for live gigs. If you're a live front house guy or on stage guy, if you think, that mic cable crackled last gig, maybe I should check it out. I'll do this gig. Check it, because you know it's going to pull down the phantom and you won't have a mic on that channel. It's going to take something out. Be paranoid.
You know what else? I'll tell you an example of one that actually happened to Stevie that he caused himself. I don't know if I've told this story on here before, but it's one of my favorites, and it was absolutely hilarious when it happened. But, and I'm not giving away any secret here, because about 25,000 people witnessed this. We were doing a show someplace, and in the early days of sequencers, Stevie used to like to have the computer with him on stage, and he would load the songs himself. He was using Texture as the sequencer. This is going way back. He would load the songs himself, and then he'd hit play, and if he wanted to speed it up or slow it down a little bit, he'd adjust the tempo, and he really was sort of driving the show. It was almost like he was his own MIDI DJ on stage. And I'll never forget, one time he loaded My Sharia Moore, and it was at, I forget the exact numbers, but I think it was at 98 beats per minute, and he wanted to slow it down a little to 95 or 96. So I used to have a video camera on his screen so I could see from off the stage what he was doing. And I saw him call up the tempo screen. He was going to lower it. It must have been set to 99 or whatever. And he hit T for tempo. And then he meant to just hit 94, but his finger brushed against the one key first. So he ended up 14. Typing it. No, 194.
Wow.
So he hit play. And at full concert volume, yeah, at full blasting volume, and it was just hilarious. And the whole audience knew what had happened. And it was just really, really funny. And the band just started laughing, and he stopped it, and he made a big joke out of it. And everybody actually who was at that show probably remembers it as their favorite part of the show, because then you're in on something that other people don't get to see. And it was hilarious, and he just laughed it off. But that was the last time he ever had the computer on stage with him.
Well, that, you know,
I said, is it really that important for you to hit Control-O to open the file? I think they'll believe it if someone else hits, you know, open.
Well, but you bring up a really good point. And as much as we rely on technology, technology will fail. So you always have
guaranteed.
To, you have to plan on some contingency plans. I my very first gig I was ever on the road with, I was the drum tech for Stryper. And Bob Sweet, the drummer, at that time, samples were the big rage and the giant, giant drum sound. And his whole kit was all trigger drums. There was not a real acoustic drum in the whole thing. Well, except his snare. His snare was acoustic. Well, anyhow, to make a long story short, we're doing this gig over at the old Ritz in New York City. And
I used to love the Ritz.
Yeah. The lights go down.
4 a.m. loadout, though. Yeah. Remember that Union gig? You couldn't get out until 4 a.m. after the club closed.
And the lights went down, and the intro music started, and I had two S900 samplers all loaded with all the samples. And one of the stagehands goes running back behind the power and knocks the power out. Oh. There goes my rack. And then he plugs it back in right away. I mean, just like, cuckoo. So it was like almost like a brownout. And I looked at my screens on the S900, and it was just like Japanese characters across all the screens. And so the intro's playing. He does the first downbeat, which is going to be this big, giant cannon sound. And my biggest fear in my head was when he goes to go, rata, it's like, ta-ta, because he's hitting all these Simmons pads. And so I'm like, I turn it off, wait a second. Everything boots up. I'm pushing in the disc, and those were the old floppy disks where they're spinning. It's taking forever. And all I remember is sitting there going, oh, please load, please load. And I'm hearing the intro music, you know, and it was the Dragnet intro. Dun, 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 dun. The story about to say, come on, go, go, go. The story about to say, oh, come on, go, go, go. He gets up. He's walking around. It's still loading. It's still loading. He walks up to the drum riser. It's still loading. Still loading. He's picking up his stick. It's still loading. And all of a sudden, you know, when the kit loads, it tells you the name of the drum kit, and it loads. And all of a sudden, I saw Bob Kit.
Really?
Oh my god. After that, the rest of the show, I was like, whatever.
You know? I know we're going long, but I have one more floppy story.
No,
if we have
okay.
time.
That's absolutely okay.
Check this out. A couple years ago, when Reagan had died, if you remember, Reagan and Ray Charles died around the same time, and some of the clever news stations showed footage of Ray Charles performing with Reagan sitting in the audience. It was at a Kennedy Center's award when Ray Charles had been honored years earlier, like 1987, 88, something like that. And all these news stations were showing this footage. Well, if the camera had been wider, what you would have seen is me at about age, I was probably 23 or 24. I had just been with Stevie not that long. Me crawling on my knees trying to get a Lin 9000 to load a floppy disk because Stevie was supposed to come out to honor Ray Charles and perform right after Ray finished singing his song. And the Lin 9000, they were really problematic back then. It just decided not to boot off the floppy. And I had a whole stack of backup floppies because they were notorious for not loading. And I just remember I was in a tux on my knees, crawling on the stage. I look up. I see Ray Charles.
He was a groupie or something coming towards him.
I must have looked completely terrified. I looked up to my left, and I see Ray Charles singing at the piano. I look out in the audience, and I see Ronald and Nancy Reagan. And I'm thinking...
And you're on your knees.
Well, I'm thinking, I just dropped out of college and moved to L.A., and this is where I find myself, you know, like a year later. I was completely terrified because the thing just wouldn't load. But just like your story, same thing. After trying 10 discs and powering the thing off and on and off and on and off and on and off and on, eventually just God smiled and the thing loaded, and it was fine. And I was just a puddle of sweat. I was so freaked out.
If you figure everything's going to go wrong, you then figure out redundancies and plans that if that happens – that you have some backup. Like you had backup floppies.
Yeah, but it almost didn't save
Yeah,
me.
But sometimes it goes wrong when you don't know it's going to go wrong and it's too late. And there are stories I can't even tell.
Well, you know what? We're gonna stop right now. But this will be a podcast, because another podcast that we're gonna do, because it's great about the stories of things going wrong. But the real great part about some of these stories is how you recover, and we're gonna have to pick that up. Right now, we're gonna take a break, and then when we come back from the break, we're gonna visit a little bit with Michael Davis. So we'll see you on the other side.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by AFEX and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And what most people don't know is right after we took our break, the whole Pro Tool system blew up and we had to figure out how to.
And they didn't have a backup. We actually did this on another day.
Backing up for wimps.
Yeah, it's 2 weeks later.
But
we're walking around underneath Nancy Reagan's legs.
But no, there's some good stories there.
I can't concentrate now.
That's right. Can't say that.
Hey, we're fortunate to have with us Michael Davis, and he's a writer-director, and Scott's actually working on his new movie, Shoot 'Em Up. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the movie?
Well, okay. Well, I've had the great honor of working with Michael, and it's a movie called Shoot 'Em Up, starring Paul Giamatti, Clive Owen, and Monica Bellucci. And actually, Michael can tell us many great things, but Michael has an amazing story about how he got the film made, and why don't you go into some of the stuff?
Well, if you want to start, well, first off, just so you know, Shoot 'Em Up stars Clive Owen, and the movie starts out with Clive Owen delivering a baby in the middle of a gunfight. And he ends up getting stuck with the baby, and he's like the angriest man in the world. And so the great thing is, you got this angry guy with the most innocent thing in the world, a baby, and all the bad guys want to kill the baby. And it's all the cool things you can do with the gunfight, which leads it to be a great opportunity for sound. And I actually am honored to be working with Scott, because he's done way more than I ever have, and I'm always learning from him. And he's so passionate. I mean, he's bringing some great stuff to the movie. You know, and Clive Owen, you know, was my dream casting. You know, I always, since I saw Croupier and the BMW films he'd done, Scott did one of the BMWs, The Hire, that Clive was fantastic in. But I was very lucky. This is my first studio movie. Prior to this, I wrote and directed 5 indie movies. One went to Slam Dance called 8 Days a Week. I did a film called 100 Girls and a follow-up 100 Women, a thing called Monster Man. And I basically had been trying for years to get my break. I wrote 35 screenplays. You know, I directed these 5 movies that I wrote. And I was about to get out of the business, because every time I made one of these small movies, I'd go into debt because the producers weren't paying me enough. And I finally said to my wife, I'm tired of being angry, and I'm tired of always going into debt. And in 6 months, if nothing happens, we should pack it up. I should get a teaching job. I ended up getting letters of recommendation from director friends and Clint Howard, who was in one of my movies, and was ready to pack it in. And I had sent this script, Shoot 'Em Up, that I wrote 7 years ago to a classmate at USC, Don Murphy. And he took a look at it and said, hey, you know, there's something here. And he submitted it to New Line Cinema. And during this time, after I had written the script, I had goofed around on my Macintosh, and I animated out 15 minutes of the movie, you know, shot for shot. It was basically what you would see in the movie, with sound effects and music, but it was all these sort of sketchy anime-like style drawings of 10 of the action scenes. So when New Line bid on the script, they say, hey, this is pretty good. You know, it starts out with a guy delivering a baby in the gunfight, you know, middle of a gunfight, and then it goes on from this. Then they go, but, you know, who are you? You know, what have you directed? We don't know you. And I showed them the animation. They go, wow, now we can see what the movie is. I mean, there's a scene where Clive Owen falls out of an airplane and he's followed by all these commandos, and it's a gunfight while everybody's free falling out of an airplane. Well, that's like awesome, you know?
Cool.
You know, it's got all these great cool things in it. And then they saw how I was going to shoot it, and they go, okay, and you've directed 5 other movies. We don't really, they're small movies, but okay, we'll give you a shot. And it just sort of became a Cinderella story that after, like, being in the business for 17 years, I was an overnight success. One of the executives there, Jeff Katz, ended up submitting the script to all the agencies and said, look at the script and look at the animation, and this is a go movie. You're going to love this. And overnight, they were offering me everybody from Denzel Washington, Russell Crowe, wow. Mel Gibson, whoever, you know. And I kept saying my favorite actor in the world for this is Clive Owen. And luckily, New Line, the head of the foreign division, says Clive Owen would be rocking for this. And Clive dropped out of another movie, and he became available. And I had drinks with him, and we hit it off. And, like, he had, like, three drinks, three beers. I was still nursing my one because I'm such a weenie. But he was laughing, and halfway through my meeting with him, I could step out of my body and watch myself and say, I'm actually doing this. I'm doing this. He's going to do the movie.
Oh, that's great.
And then it just fell into place. Paul Giamatti is awesome in the movie.
He's amazing.
He plays the villain. He played all these other characters that were sort of low self-esteem characters, and here he gets to play this, like, cocky guy that comes after Clive Owen with an army of killers. Monica Bellucci plays the hot, you know, lactating hooker, and you got a movie.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing. Well, you know, I will tell you, you know, speaking of just what a small planet this is, the very first film that I ever worked on as a dialogue editor was actually one of your movies.
Well, I was just the writer on that. but I do have to tell you, that movie actually got me my first feature directing gig.
Oh, that's great.
Because I was working for Charlie Band, and on Prehysteria 2, the director hated the script, and they were shooting in 2 weeks. And Charlie Band and his company says, well, Michael, we love your writing. Will you do a rewrite really quick? You have 2 weeks. Well, in 4 days, I had done a page one rewrite, and they loved it, and I should have quit right after this. They read it, and they had no notes. No notes.
Wow.
Wow.
And so then 3 weeks later, they go, we're going to shoot Prehysteria 3 right after Prehysteria 2. And if you do another page one rewrite in 4 days like you did before, we'll let you direct the other script you wrote for us, which was a thing called Beanstalk. And so they let me direct because I could write my way into it.
Well, good for you. You know, I will also recommend the 8 Days a Week. That's a great film. It just has a lot of heart, and it's just a great film.
It's an early Kerry Russell. I do have to say that I won an Anatomy Award for that. Do you know what an Anatomy Award is from Mr. Skin?
No.
Anyway, he rates all the sort of sexy scenes in movies, from R-rated movies to whatever. And I won in 1988 for Best Wet T-Shirt Scene. I was on – Howard Stern was talking to Mr. Skin, and he says, okay, so what is the best wet T-shirt scene in the history of cinema? And Mr. Skin goes, well, obviously it's Jacqueline Bisset in The Deep, you know. But a close runner-up is Michael Davis's 8 Days a Week. So anyway,
wow, your parents must be proud.
No, they think I do pornography.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the collaboration here with the director and the sound designer. When you approach the film Shoot 'Em Up, how do you convey to Scott your kind of vision for the sounds? I mean, do you say, hey, look at that, one sounds like this or that, or do you put a lot of it in just in his hands?
You know, I have to say, I put a lot of it in Scott's hands. Really what it is where we first met, it was sort of a vibe. And Scott has this amazing passion about movies and sound and how he creates sounds and using abstract sounds to create sounds that feel cinematically real. Like, I have to say, just to jump in, he came up with this brilliant idea. We have these bullets in our movies that have to zing by. He recorded NASCARs. Zoom, zoom, zoom. And then he filtered them and did all his crazy magic, and it sounds so incredible. And you never heard bullets like this before. So it's sort of like we had an energy connect, and then I just turned it over to him, and it's amazing. It's like so easy for me. I mean, he's the genius behind the sound. I mean, we talk, but then, and then he also kind of educates me what the movie should be.
And Scott, as from
what he said,
no, but from a sound designers, when a director is putting that much faith into you, I mean, what kind of responsibility do you feel, and what made you go to that NASCAR sound? And
you know, it's interesting. The movie's about guns, and what's kind of fun about the movie is that we have to come up with all these different sequences for gunfights, and without giving anything away in the movie. There are gun fights of every type that you can ever imagine. So it's easy just to get it boring, because if you start doing gunshot after gunshot after gunshot, it becomes a one-trick pony, and it can exhaust the audience, and it kind of goes nowhere quickly. So we had to look at each gun battle and kind of come up with, you know, what are we going to do? Paul Hossling is the composer, Is it going to be a music moment? Is it going to be a design moment? Is it going to be guns up front? What kind of ricos are happening? And what it is working with the picture cuts, working with the composition. Also, we want to make sure we don't fatigue the audience. It is a loud mix because it's got to have that energy. It's got to rock the room, but at the same point, it's got to be easy to listen to. And, you know, it's like sculpting marble. Instead of being an additive process, many times it's a subtractive process. And we spend a lot of time putting everything in, listening to it and going, okay, let's take out this, let's take out this, let's take out that, and then really molding it into each scene where it really becomes a gem.
Now, what made you think about the NASCAR sound? I mean, that's
well,
a
actually,
pretty genius.
And llamas. No, sorry. it's an ongoing joke. you know, it's something that when I was doing actually Herbie, and we were recording all these NASCARs, we did a whole bunch of recordings right off the fence. And as the NASCARs were going by, they didn't sound like cars. They actually sounded like lasers. And it was one of those things you go, wow, one day I'm going to have to use that. So you take the recording, you put it aside, and you don't even think about it. So when we were doing the guns, we really used about 6 or 7 different types of guns. We did recording shoots. We bought tombstones.
Tell them about, yeah, shooting against tombstones.
Yeah, we bought a tombstone. And really heavy. It was only like 2x2 and about 2 inches thick, and it took 4 guys to carry it.
Wow.
So we went out into the desert, brought automatic weapons, and had our way with it. We recorded all these exotic things. We brought muskets and redid the powder content, so they were barely had enough powder, and we filed the bullets. So as they went, they twirled and whizzed and whistled, and they created all these amazing tones that as they went flying through the air, and we had mics spread out 100 yards. We had 27 microphones.
Holy smokes.
And
it was 107 degrees that day, right?
It was the hottest day. This was last summer, and we've been on this project for almost a year, and it was last summer, and it just happened to be the hottest day of the summer. So we start off. Everyone's running. We have about 6 of us. Well out there, and at the end it was like, okay, let's do this. And nobody can move fast. And we're drinking water. We're not even sweating the water out. It's just evaporating on our bodies. And it was, and the wind was blowing. But no, we got some amazing sounds. We used a lot of music type sounds, trying to enhance the low end. And again, you know, we had the guns. They sounded good. We had all these exotic. But they still sounded too plain. They sounded like a gun.
Right.
Even though no gun was one recording, it was multiple recordings. And we felt that there's such an impishness and a funness to the movie that the sound had to follow it. So we needed to be almost as outrageous. So I just said, you know what? Let's pick out the NASCARs. We took pennies. We threw slingshots and bent them up and did whizzes and slowed them down and manipulated it. And then we, with Paul's music, and Paul's got, I mean, how would you describe Paul's music?
It's rock and roll action music.
Yeah, I mean, it's got a lot of different textures. It's got synth textures, a lot of percussion. And I've known Paul for many, many years. We had to kind of work around each other because a lot of the design we're doing, like we did giant engine starts, you know, where the valves of an engine flip?
Right.
It was boom. And then these low-end pops, that's part of the body falls. So when the bodies fall, there's like this. So these really big falls because you don't want to hear like click. Right. This is way over the top. It's got to be fun. And you have to think outside the box. And as sound designer, you become an audio photographer. And you just remember all these things that you did like 10 years ago or 6 years ago and say, I can use that now, or go out and record it.
But also conceptually, he came in and says, you know what? Clive has to have the big gun.
Yeah.
And didn't you use 5 gunshots to make Clive's one gunshot?
Yeah, and Clive's gun is literally a 5.1 gun. I mean, it takes up the whole theater. And also, it's the scene because I find it all music. It's like, bam, da, 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 bam. And you're looking at your accents.
Oh, yeah.
So everything's rhythmically based so that you've got to accent the cut. And is it the last gunshot? Is it the first gunshot? Is it a bunch of guys shooting? Is it a call and answer? when I look at the way it was set up, it's very musical. So you have to approach it in the same way.
Now, for the signature guns, is Clive the only signature gun? Or is
no, Clive, Clive's got Paul Giamatti has the biggest gun in the movie. Is a Desert Eagle.
Oh, okay.
Now, I don't know what you did to build it, but it's just as big as Clive's gun. What'd
and
you
it's
do?
And it's different. I mean, again, we've taken all these different pistols. We've taken rifles. We developed our own things. We manipulated stuff and really tried to give each character their own gun within that scene. Because sometimes, like, Paul will whip out a gun from his sock or something. And sometimes I may want a splatty gun because it's a smaller piece. You've got to look at the emotional element within the scene to figure out how to best tell the story. And there's even a point where they use a small gun. And conceptually, a lot of people would say, well, it's a small gun. It's a this kind of gun. So I have to make it sound like this. Nah. You know what? It's fun. And at that point, it needs to be a cannon. Just because it is what it is.
Now, with all that gunfight and all the gun sounds, do you find that you had to bring down, like, less Foley, less hard effects? Are the BGs a little lighter just to make room for everything? Or
you know,
how do you keep it from getting so crowded?
Because of foreigns and because of M&Es, we actually have to build everything. And, you know, there were areas that I knew we were going to lose, like right off. But I still have to build it because you never know what the dynamics are. We went through a lot of music changes where we were trying to figure out the style of the music along the way. And each style change totally changed my sound effects and changed the concept of how we were going to go after the mix. So when we finally landed it, you build it and then you take it away. That's what's talking about the marble.
Right. Yeah, it's like musically we had during the skydive a Prodigy piece. And then the head of the studio says, you know, I love this movie. Why don't you spend more money on the music? And we ended up spending money on an AC/DC tune. You know, you want blood, you got it. But that changed Scotty's all of his gunshots in there.
Yeah.
And then not only that, one of the things we did was as these guys were free-falling, and not to intellectualize it, but as they're diving and they're like little jet planes, they really don't make sound. But the moment they're hit and they create an air distortion, all the sound appears, and I do these giant octave drops on the low end, which rock the room, and all of a sudden create this, it almost feels like drums. And then they fly out of the screen. So now all of a sudden we got to make it exciting because a lot of the music, because we were dealing with a lot of songs, kind of find a groove, and they kind of stick to the groove, and they're not accenting anything within the scene. Right. So I've got to take my design, make it musical, and sometimes you don't even know if it's music or design, because I've got to make hit those moments.
Yeah, because the music is not hitting it, so he has to do what score would have done for it.
Right.
Yeah.
Also, didn't you do something with the bullets flying in the skydive to make a different kind of sound
yeah,
for the
you know,
bullet flying?
Again, they're machine guns. So what we did was they start off, we hear the bullet buys that morph into guns. So as they're coming in, so you don't hear the guns, you hear the bullet buys first.
Right.
And we have to take the cyclic rate of a machine gun, time out all the bullet buys by hand. It was laborious as hell. Because they're going, you know. So, and there were lots of them. So, and then you have to pan them. So then you've got to figure out which way they're coming, and they're in all different directions.
Wow. So, Michael, do you remember the first time that you heard a playback of the effects? I mean,
I was blown away because, you know, it's people, if they don't know, half the movie is the sound. If you don't have the sound there, it doesn't rock, especially in a gunfight, if you don't have it. So you're playing it, and I'd seen it in the editing room. Yeah, it's pretty cool, pretty cool. And then you put in the gunshots, you go, wow, I'm blown away. I feel it. I mean, the shockwaves, just the vibrations make you go, wow, wow, thank you, Scott. You made my movie.
Now, how do you keep the, you know, you're impressed and you've got that whole just wall of sound coming at you. Yet, as a director, you also have to make, you know, calls on the stage. I mean, how do you separate that enthusiasm? Because I know if I was me, I'd go, I love it all, put it all and more, you know? And yet, there were some decisions that had to be made. I mean, was it a collaborative effort?
You know, I have to tell you, I mean, I'm not an expert at sound. Sure. But, you know, I told Scott this when I was a kid, you know, I didn't listen to music. I told you before this that my first album I brought was a Partridge Family album. I'm a musical idiot, whatever. But what I used to do is I would record the James Bond movies off ABC or sometimes go to the movie theater and record the movies. And I would play these literally over and over again, hundreds and hundreds of times, that I had memorized, like in Goldfinger when he's like looking for, you know, the girl is sneaking up and he meets the girl. Anyway, I can remember the sound of the footsteps crackling on the leaf. Mm. And because I had heard all these little funny sounds that kind of add to the rhythm and the music of the sound effect, right. I think I absorbed a little bit of that. So when you're playing it, I can feel like, you know, there's something missing. Like there was a scene where Scotty had actually tried it, but I decided it wasn't, it was fighting the music, but I said, you need to hear the shells ding, 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 ding on the floor. Can you try it again? And they tried it again. I go, yeah, I think that was what was missing for me. So hopefully I, you know, have a little bit of talent at this, and I just act as sort of the objective ears. He's so involved that I'm sort of just like out there saying, how about this?
This was one of the harder mixes I think I've done, strangely enough. Literally, we have been dealing with 1.5 dB increments.
Wow.
I mean, it's that tight because it's so loud and there's so much happening that if you, let's say, move the music 1 dB up, it just obliterated a whole bunch of things.
Wow.
And usually when people say, yeah, bring it up a dB, I'm like, yeah, okay, right. Because it doesn't do much.
Right.
But no, this was, we've been dealing with those increments. And what's important was, and it's not only about the guns or the music, it's really about the weave of what we were trying to create. Because some of the songs have this great little talk box on the guitar. And I really wanted to accentuate it because, like a little gun, a little talk box, a little rhythm. And you keep weaving it to make it interesting for the audience, that they keep hearing interesting sounds that help enhance the storytelling.
Wow. And are you guys, what stage did you mix it on?
Right now we're over at Taddeo and over at Seward.
Are you still in the
dubbing? Yeah, we've got two more days. We're in fixed mode. We've made our final pass. We print master on Thursday. Friday.
Wow.
I'm stoked. I'm almost done.
And the reason I start off with that was because I left the house this morning at 5 in the morning. We did playback for the studio at 7 a.m.
Holy smokes.
And you know, really, if you start shooting at 6 a.m., I cry me a river, though. I have to tell you. Try getting up at 6 a.m. after you've been up till midnight shooting and stressing out. So
that's why I'm a sound guy.
Yeah, we can't use those stories with a director here. They're first on, last off, you know?
Yeah.
Well, great. Man, thank you so much. And that's, you know, for coming here and telling us a little about your movie. And when is the movie open?
It's September 7th.
September 7th. And it's a New Line release. And we'll be
And also, are there some websites with your drawings out there, isn't there?
Yeah, you know, there's a place called Latino Review that ended up bootlegging my animation. And you can see the animation, like about 5 minutes of it.
Oh, great.
It's pretty amazing.
That's great. Well, that's great. Well, hey, thank you for joining us
on
the Audio Nowcast. It was a blast, and I'm looking forward to listening to all those gunshots, especially now that I want to hear
and the soundtrack. It's not the guns. It's not it's the soundtrack.
All right, the soundtrack. And Michael, you've put your trust in a man who's more than capable to make that sound come true. So
it's unbelievable.
Okay, well, before we go, Martin. David from Connecticut had a question that I wanted you to answer.
It's about guns or anything?
It's about recording guns on cassettes. No, but he was asking because on one of the podcasts you mentioned that you used to master to cassettes, and he was asking you how you did that because apparently he still records
the cassettes. Yeah, I think he was probably thinking that I was recording everything on the cassettes, but really what I do with it, David, is I just use a cassette player, a small cassette player, around the house everywhere where I'm, you know, working, so that at a pinch I can just record anything at any time. The cassette player is just really a handheld quickie, so I can get my ideas down wherever I am, and that's what I use a cassette player for. Nothing for mastering, but just purely as an ideas machine. And I still use it. You know, you can use digital recorders like this now, but I'm still in love with the old cassette because it seems so rough and ready. And that means I'm recording stuff and not treasuring it too much. That's what I use a cassette player for.
Do they still sell cassette tapes?
Yes, they do. Only to me. I've been keeping them in business.
I don't even remember the last time I even...
Tape. It's beautiful. It's beautiful.
Do you have a cassette, Rob? Do you have a cassette deck?
I do.
When was the last time you used it?
I've been in my studio now
6.5 years, and it has been used twice. Twice I've had people come over with cassette
I know
tapes.
You're going to ask me this question too, aren't you?
Go on, buddy.
I'll give you the answer. Yes, I have.
Yay!
And the last time I used it was a year ago.
Good man.
I put some real brass on a project, but they wanted to sound funky, and I couldn't find a decent plug-in to screw it up. So I've got a two-head cassette machine. I put it through there. Recorded back there.
Genius.
Adjust the bias on it, and it sounded horrible. It was like beautiful.
Genius.
And it hissed like hell.
Genius.
Andrew, brilliant. You had a cassette?
Yeah, and I actually use the machine all the time as a headphone amp, among other things.
Oh, okay.
But, and also I use it to distort. You go in the front of that on the mic input with a line level and crank it up, and nothing distorts like that.
Wow. Scott, cassette? You got a cassette, Doug?
What's a cassette?
There you go.
Well, that's 4 out of 6. Not bad.
I work at a facility. We don't have a cassette deck in the whole facility. They brought in a tape, and one of the machine guys had to bring his from home or something
like
that.
No, 8-track.
8-track. All right. Well, hey, the other thing I wanted to mention really quick is, I don't know if you guys know, but on iTunes, have you seen the fact that you can put a playlist together and you can actually publish the playlist on iTunes? I think we're going to do an Audio Nowcast playlist, and what that's going to mean is everybody's going to submit a song or two that we're going to put a playlist together, and in a couple weeks we'll post it on iTunes, and it'll be the Audio Nowcast playlist. So, guys, start thinking of your songs that you want to contribute to that.
Can I put in "I Think I Love You" by David Cassidy?
absolutely. But that, and I bring that up because I got a gift. A dear friend of mine gave me a gift from iTunes, and they gifted me an album, and that was just – it was an amazing experience because it just comes to you, and you click on it, and next thing you know it opens up iTunes, and it downloads it, and you've got that album right there. And, you know, it's just –
Partridge Family?
No, but it's just – you know, it's that whole paradigm. I mean, slowly but surely, things like this are going to change. I mean, I'm sure you all remember, you know, when you're growing up, you're making that mix – you know, that little cassette for that special somebody in your life or that friend or something like that. And now the fact that you can do that on iTunes and then publish it and other people can, you know,
because it's so easy to do, doesn't it take the meaning out of doing your,
you know, you would think so. And I'm putting a playlist together because I wanted to try this. So I'm putting a playlist together for a friend, and actually, yes, it can if you just do it really fast. But the fact is what if you could listen to small snippets on any song that you want, and you can really kind of craft how your playlist sounds. Because a lot of times when you put a mixtape together, or even when you're just organizing this, you know, like the songs in your album, you know how important it is, Martin, when you listen to songs and how one can lead to another, and you try different things like that. Well, with iTunes now, you can listen to a little bit, and you can listen to a little bit to the next one, and you can move them around, and you can really, I mean, it's, you've got, you know,
but I got one question for you. Say Anything. John Cusack is holding up the big cassette player.
Yeah.
Could he hold up an iPod?
They have boom boxes where you can put your iPod
on. Oh, you're right. Okay. I'm totally wrong.
Actually, my song.
Right. My song, have one of those.
My song was in Say Anything. In that.
Your song
in
was
that
there?
Place, yeah. That was it.
Great movie.
Yeah. That's interesting you mentioned that.
But
yeah.
Somebody will do the
and
iPod
it was a
version.
Though,
that's
yeah.
a great commercial for iPod.
Yeah, actually, yeah. You're right. That
we should
is.
Do it.
But, it just got me thinking. And it's just, you know, slowly but surely, this is just, it's just yeah. weaving its way in. And it's
well, that iTunes album is a nice way to be able to say to someone, you know, I love you enough to click a mouse 10 times. Which is really heartwarming.
But the question is, which mouse?
Wow.
I'm sorry, everybody.
No, but really, though, I mean, you can just really craft and hone some really great, great mixes. And
unless you want Beatles songs.
Well, yeah, that's true, too. Yeah. But they're coming. All right, guys. Well, hey.
Well, you know, if you're plugging iTunes, can I say one other thing?
Sure.
I cut my animation with iMovie, and then I downloaded music from iTunes. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have to do anything, didn't have to buy any CDs. And so, you know, I'm a huge Mac fan. Yeah.
So what that means is, in this multimedia world, it's beyond that. It's now iMovie. So send somebody an iMovie with the songs and the pictures that you care about. And then try to make sure your wife doesn't find out.
Well, hey, we're going to be wrapping it up here, and if anybody has any comments or questions, they can always email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. Or you can visit us on our MySpace. It's myspace.com/audionowcast. And before we go, Rob, you working on anything fun and exciting that you can talk about?
let me think. Well, we just wrapped up two promo campaigns for the Judge Joe Brown show and for a show called Half and Half, which are campaigns that actually were in process for a really long time.
Oh, really?
And they will be on the air soon. And actually working on a few music projects that I'll be able to talk about in the next few podcasts with some artists from different countries, some interesting stuff we're putting together.
Great.
And the furniture still isn't in. I'll just put that little plug.
Really?
Thank God.
But it's coming. I actually went to the factory. I saw them building it. It is a reality.
I think we should do the podcast at the factory, on your furniture.
I got news for you. If it doesn't show up by the next podcast, we may just do that. No, they're working on it. It's going to be beautiful.
We're waiting for the pictures.
Yeah. You and me both.
Andrew.
In a couple of weeks, I'm going to be going to London for the Live Earth concert at Wembley with the Chili Peppers, but I'm also very excited because Spinal Tap will be playing.
Oh.
And if you haven't seen it, go to the Live Earth website, and there is a movie about getting Spinal Tap back together for this gig that is hilarious.
Oh, I got to check it out.
Great.
Coincidentally, I'm going to be in England at the same time. I may just pop up.
Yes.
Bobby, what are you working on? Anything?
Nothing major. Let me just think. Oh, I've just been doing a bunch of demos for Don't Forget the Lyrics, a TV Fox show coming out, but doesn't look like it's going, and I'm doing One Life to Live underscore stuff.
This All right.
Last 2 weeks.
Hey, I'm doing a movie called Shoot 'Em Up.
That's it, Scott?
That's all you're going to get.
That's all you're going to get.
And Martin.
Well, we just finished the EPK with you, Mike. We did some interviews on the weekend,
yes.
And I was very, very pleased with that. I was interviewed by Rich Ezra, who did a great job. And I'm looking forward to editing it with you in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah,
that's been fun.
That'll be kind of fun. And Michael, what are your plans after this movie?
Well, you know, I'd like to continue on as a writer-director, so I'm working on a new script, and we'll see what happens.
All right, well, we wish you a lot of success in all your future endeavors. All right, well, hey, this is Mike Rodriguez, and from the guys, thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez with Rob Arbatier, Scott Gershon, Martin Page, Andrew Sheps, and Bobby Summerfield. The program is produced by April Mastropalo and uses Apex's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.